Okay guys, so welcome back to another episode, and hopefully this will be the last of the four parts to the Manowar core rulebook. And just before we get on to the scenarios and campaign rules, I just want to touch on the wizards and magic that's sort of before the fleets and that kind of thing. Before the previous episode, we sort of just jumped straight into the fleets and all the different races and that kind of thing. They do have like an introduction to the fleet lists, and that covers the point costs and that kind of thing. They recommend a standard size of 1,000 points to buy your fleet with. So that's kind of, I think, you know, in terms of gameplay, people tend to just do 1,000 point games. That will probably get you about, I don't know, 7 to 10 ships in your fleet, because you need to still pay for a wizard as well and your mana war cards, so you need to allow some points for that as well. I'm just going to read you the example that they give in the rule book. So for example, you have chosen an Empire fleet. According to the Empire fleet list, the fleet must contain one great ship to be the Admiral's flagship. It must also include one squadron of war galleys and one squadron of warships. Since you must have these, it's time to spend some points. A great ship costs 150 points, a squadron of warships costs 300 points, and a squadron of war galleys costs 150 points. You think it's a good idea to have a wizard and choose a master wizard at 100 points. This leaves you with 300 points. You can purchase another squadron of warships. You could have purchased two more squadrons of war galleys. Alternatively, you could have had two more great ships and one more great ship and a squadron of war galleys. So that's just an example of how you can spend your 1,000 points, as that's kind of where they find it's a sweet spot in terms of point values. I've been playing only 600 point games, and I found that they are just fine as is. So it's really flexible in the, you know, but you need to stick with the limitations depending on the fleet. So you must have obviously the flagship for the Admiral. Then it will probably have some kind of, as we talked about in the fleets before, like a 1+ or 2+. So you need to have 2 or 1 of something before you can go any further. And there's other limitations too that goes through in each of the different races. But that's basically just a brief, you know, outline of the points costs and how you construct an army. Admirals, okay, they have a little one-page thing here on admirals. In boarding actions, they get a +1 dice roll added to the boarding action if your admiral's on your ship, on the flagship, I'd say. Clinging to the wreckage, we talked about this before, so if they're clinging to the wreckage, then he can be saved and rescued if your ship on the same turn is in contact with the wreckage. They can pick him up and put him on their ship. Otherwise, he's going to sink if you don't rescue him that turn. Battle honors. If the Admiral is picked up by the enemy, he is captured. This represents a considerable humiliation for the owning player and will give his foe extra battle honors at the end of the game. If the Admiral is picked up by his own player's ship, place his counter on the appropriate ship template. He can now be used again as normal. So the Admiral is worth 5 battle honors if he is captured. I think if you kill him, as in if his ship goes down and he goes down with it, they get 5 points as well, 5 battle honors as well. I would take that to be the case. Okay, so wizards and magic, we're just going to go really briefly over this because we covered sort of magic before and how to cast spells. It's just got, you know, an out pretty much like a introduction to all the colleges of magic, because if people haven't never seen Warhammer before, it gives them a good idea of, they get like a nice illustration of the college wheel and all the different symbols that are representative of the different colleges, and a very brief sort of one paragraph introduction and background to each college, which is quite cool. Some great artwork again from the artists here, John Blanche and Wayne England, as well on here. Then, you know, how to choose your wizard, the points, costs, and that kind of thing, and how to determine your college color, which we've talked about before in an early episode. Boarding actions, they have no effect on boarding actions, so they don't add any dice or anything like that to your boarding action when a wizard is on the ship. Cling to the wreckage, so just like the Admiral, he can cling to the debris, and during the end phase, players may attempt to rescue him. While the wizard is adrift, cling to the wreckage, he may not cast spells. As soon as the wizard goes overboard, discard all of your magic cards. To effect a rescue, a player's ship must be touching the wreck or debris marker. If both players have ships touching the wreck or debris marker, the wizard will swim to the ship of his own fleet, which makes sense. And battle honors, yeah. So your opponent claims the battle honors when he is captured. And I take it if he dies or something. I'm assuming that they get the battle honors if he dies as well, but it only says if the wizard is picked up by the enemy, he is captured. This represents considerable humiliation for the owning player and will give his foe extra battle honors at the end of the game. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they have to capture him to get the battle honors, like your admiral. I'll have to ask that to the group, actually. Because if you sink the ship that he's on and he dies, do you still claim... Oh, hang on, sorry. No, that's right, yeah, so they have a battle honors worth for each different level. So I need to check that in the group, because it doesn't actually specifically say if he dies. Mana War cards. Now, we haven't gone through these yet, so I'm just going to give them a very brief overview. I'm not going to go through all the cards. I'm just going to say there are four types. There's a hull card. These have a symbol of like anchor symbol on the card, which are situated right at the dead center top of the cards, and will say hull on it, for example. These cards, when you draw them randomly and you pay 25 points for them, of course, then they can be used and put on your ships as you see fit. Now, there's hull cards that obviously give you, you know, effects that, you know, improve your ship's maybe speed, or maybe making it difficult to hit, or other things like that. Gun cards, which obviously affect the weaponry on your ship. Crew cards affect the crew, and they obviously make them better. And special cards. And these do some kind of, or give you some kind of unusual benefit to this ship as well. So the main rule for the Mana War cards is that no Mana War may have more than one card with the same symbol on it. Otherwise, there are no limits, or no other limits, to the number of Mana War cards a ship may have. I'm thinking that the maximum they can have is equal to the crew on the ship. So if, for example, the War Gully, we use that ship a lot for an example, but the War Gully has two crew, I think it can only have a maximum of two cards, I think. Because I know in the Plague Fleet expansion, the Chaos War Gullies, which are the equivalent to the War Gullies for the Imperial side, can only have an equal amount of rewards, the reward cards, to the crew or the below the waterline hit locations, I believe. So I'm sure there's going to be something in here that specifies that, but I can't see it. It just says there's no other limits, there's no other restrictions on it. So I could be wrong, could be right, I don't know. We can always check the Facebook groups and ask the guys there if we need any clarification on that. And then they just go into ship types, the men of war, obviously the huge warships that your admiral will be riding on or not. It could be just a standalone independent men of war, because you can have more than one of them in most cases. Ships of the line, the sort of the backbone of your fleet, and the independent ships, as the name suggests, they are independent. They don't activate or are part of any squadrons. Okay, so we just got through that really briefly, so that was good. And then we can head into the scenarios and the campaign rules, which I was really excited about when I learnt about through Jesse that he told me, oh yeah, they've got scenarios and they've got campaign rules, and I thought, oh great, because I really love all that kind of stuff. Just pitch battles are fun in its own right, because you know, Man of War, we're sort of learning and we're just doing the sort of more of a pitch battle approach to the games, just lining up on either side and going for it. But you know, I like to have scenarios too. So it says here, once you've played a few games of Man of War, you may want to try some of the scenarios given in this section. Scenarios add an extra level of excitement to your games because they give you objectives to fight towards, quite apart from the ultimate goal of destroying your opponent's fleet. So, there are 6 scenarios in the base game. There are another 6 in the Plague Fleet expansion too. And we'll get to that and we'll talk about those. I've not played the Plague Fleet scenarios, and I've not actually played all of these ones in the book here too, in the core rules, because I've only played, I think I've only played one of them. I think it's only After the Storm. In our games, I think we just normally do pitch battles, but I really want to try some of the other ones, and I'm going to play a game with Marcel this Saturday evening. So I'm going to try, and obviously that's going to be way after this is released anyway, but I'm going to try to ask him to see what if we can play a scenario of some kind. So let's go briefly through what each scenario is. Okay, so number one, After the Storm. Now this is quite a cool one actually. I did play this one with Ben, and he was playing the Skaven and I was playing the Dark Elves. Which didn't really overly affect our fleets because his ships move by paddles, and my ships are monsters mostly, and my Black Ark does move by sails, but it also moves magically, so it didn't really affect our squadron so much, because as the name and the title suggests, it's just after this big storm has ripped through the seascape, and your opponent can place your models anywhere in your deployment zone, and you do also the same for him. So you can face them anywhere you want. You can't place them within 2 inches of terrain or the table edge, and that's the only kind of restriction. You know, obviously they've got to be placed in squadrons, okay? So you can't have them, you can't have stragglers from the get-go. You know, they need to actually be placed within 6 inches of their, what's it called again? I forgot. Of their main ship, their flagship, that's it. We got it back. So once a tempest has passed, both sides frantically try to reassemble their fleets. More by luck than judgment, they have ended up in the same area and must hastily form up for battle. So it's a really good one, I think, for ships that really rely on turning, because I was really lucky because I could just spin on the spot with my Black Ark, but poor old Ben, he had to turn everything, because even though he's using the steam paddles, he doesn't have oars, so he has to turn like any other ship. But he didn't have to worry about the wind, so if he was turning into the wind, he wouldn't stop, he would just keep going. Okay, so that was the first one. Now, the second one is Treacherous Waters. Now, this scenario is played exactly as the basic game, except for the fact that all the quadrants of the table must have the maximum amount of terrain on them. Wow. In fact, you may place all the terrain in the box if both players agree. Play proceeds as normal. It says this is a particularly nasty variation of this theme is to combine this scenario with the setting up rules for the After the Storm. Only use this variant if both players agree. Yeah, that would be terrible if you had After the Storm plus Treacherous Waters combined, but I can see, and plus if you had particular magic spells that pushed, or you were able to move ships and crash them into the terrain features. That'd be quite nasty. So I've not tried this one. I'll be interested to try it, actually. I might see if me and Marcel can try this, or me and Ben at some point, and give this one a go. That looks quite cool. Okay, let's go to number three. So in the jaws of a trap, one fleet has managed to isolate and ambush a sizable section of the other. The smaller fleet is doomed unless it can fight its way off the table and out of the jaws of the trap. So, first we roll the dice. The player with the lowest score has been trapped. His fleet may only be half the points cost of his opponent's. He sits up on the east or west side of the table and can exit from the table only on the opposite side. The other player must split his fleet into two equal halves. One half sets up within 9 inches of the north edge of the table, and the other sets up within 9 inches of the southern edge of the table. Play now proceeds as normal. The trap player gains battle honors as usual for enemy ship sunk or captured. Additionally, every ship he gets off the opposite edge of the table, he gets battle honors for. The game ends when he surrenders or has more ships on the table. The ambushing player gets battle honors for sinking or capturing enemy ships as usual. Okay, so that's kind of like a little bit like Breakthrough in the 5th edition fantasy scenarios. It sort of reminds me of that in a little bit. But yeah, that looks quite cool too. I wouldn't mind trying that as well. It looks like a quite a good scenario. Okay, let's go to number 4. Now this one's Buried Gold. One admiral has acquired a map containing the location of buried treasure. Spies have informed the admiral of the enemy fleet of this, and he has put to sea in hot pursuit. Unfortunately, the map was not very accurate. The island must be scoured for treasure, since it would be bad for them to return empty-handed. During setup, the terrain is placed. Choose one island to be the treasure island. The terrain piece is put in the center of the table. Terrain is set up and play can now proceed as normal. Okay, so a ship which ends its movement within 1 inch of the central island can anchor and send landing parties ashore. Take as many crew companies as you like from the ship's template and place them on the island. These are your landing parties. You should place the landing parties in separate piles and put them near the ship they came from. This will let you know which ship they return to. If that ship sails off in the next movement phase, they take off the boats and go off with it. If the ship is attacked while at anchor, they will return to defend it. In the end phase, they may search for treasure. For each landing party, roll the dice and consult the following table. So look at this quick table here. So one, the landing party is consumed by fearsome monsters. It's probably the worst one you can roll. 2 to 5, the treasure can no treasure to be found. Try again next turn. Okay. And obviously 6, they have found the treasure. Yay! Okay, so once the treasure has been located, no more searches can be made. During the movement phase of the next turn, the landing party can return to the ship and then can sail away. Place a treasure chest on its template. If the ship is captured in a boarding action, its captor seizes a chest and places it on the ship's template. If both sides manage to place landing parties on the island, then in the end phase, a massive battle ensues. Both players roll a dice and add the total number of landing parties on their side. Highest total is the winner. The loser loses one crew company. If it's a draw, both sides lose one crew company. If crew companies from more than one ship are involved, then the losing player gets to pick up from which ship they came. There is no retreat from this battle. It carries on until one side has been slaughtered. Wow. Their red-handed foes get to search the island in the end phase or the next turn if they are not attacked again. Both sides receive battle honors for enemies sunk and captured. The player who manages to get the ship with the treasure chest off the table gains a further 5 battle honors. That seems like a really bloody and gruesome scenario. I'm just wondering whether it'd be better for just let your opponent to get the treasure, get it on a ship, hope that, you know, a lot of his landing party were consumed by monsters, and then as they're looking for the treasure, just keep sniping and shooting their and ramming their vessels as they're anchored at the island. Maybe that's a good tactic. Or maybe I'm just being really, really terrible in thinking that would be a good tactic. I don't know. So number five, the treasure fleet. The treasure fleet is returning home, groaning under the weight of gold in its hold. Enemy spies have found out the fleet's course and a strong force has been dispatched to intercept it. The treasure fleet must fight its way through or its admiral will face disgrace or worse on his return home. Roll a dice. The player with the highest score is the treasure fleet. He takes three treasure chest counters and places them on the templates of three of his ships, one on each ship. Now both sides play ships and terrain and play proceeds as normal, as usual. When a treasure ship is captured during a boarding action, the winning player can transfer a treasure chest to his own ship's template. Battle honors are rewarded as usual. In addition, for each ship with a treasure chest counter, he manages to get off the opposite side of the table. The treasure fleet player receives three battle honors. For each ship carrying a treasure chest he managed to get off his own table edge, the intercepting player gets three battle honors. Okay, I quite like that scenario too. And maybe this one's a good one that we can play in a near future game. Now, number six, Storm the Shore Forts. Now, this one's got quite a lot of rules. It's got a new piece of scenery. It actually has its own template for it as well. So it's got crew. It's got three crew on the shorefront. It's got three hit locations, four, five, and six. It has a left, center, and right cannon battery, which contain one cannon for each battery. It's got, it looks like you have to capture it or destroy it. It's got three structural damages. It's immune to rams or rammers running aground, so you can't take it out that way. Okay, how can we take it out? Let's read the rules here. So the sixth scenario includes a new piece of scenery, the shore fort. The seascape represents bordering territorial waters between two nations at war. Aha, I sort of get the idea now. The waters are guarded by shore forts, and the fleets of the nations are determined to destroy their opponent's shore fort as quickly as possible. I like this one already, actually. Set up the terrain as normal, choose table edge as usual. Choose your fleets as usual, except that each player gets a shore fort at no points cost, which he places as a squadron when the fleets are deployed. The shore fort is treated exactly like an extra squadron in your fleet, subject to the rules below. Okay, victory conditions. The first player to reduce the opponent's shore fort to rubble is the winner. He gains 15 battle honors. Wow, that's huge. There are no other battle honors gained in any other way in this scenario. You get no battle honors for sinking or capturing enemy ships. Note that if you are buying a shore fort for your fleet under normal circumstances, it's only worth 5 battle honors. Okay. Well, I didn't know you can actually buy one. Obviously, you can. So it goes on about the templates. Operates just like a ship. Split into different areas, and each area houses a cannon battery. There is no high or low areas. Moving, the shore fort cannot move. Well, that's no surprise. Firing a shore fort when firing at a shore fort, you do not aim high or low. Simply fire at the shore fort. Okay, that seems very straightforward so far. It's got a saving throw. The shore fort is very tough. It cannot be sunk and is immune to rams. Okay, we know all that. So it gets a 3+ normal save, 3+ save, and normal save a modifiers apply. So at close range, you'll be saving on a 4+. Taking damage. If a shorefront takes damage, it loses a gun battery. Wow, each location has a damage box in it. Each damage box represents a gun battery. Okay, so it just works just like a normal ship template in that regard. If they get hit, like if you roll 4, 5, or 6 when you're hitting the shore fort, they fail the saving throw. It takes 1 point of structural damage and kill one crew counter, crushed by the falling masonry. Cool. When it takes 3 points of damage, it's destroyed. Firing from a shore fort. Shore Fort. The cannons on the Shore Fort have 360-degree arcs of fire. Okay, well, that means can be fired at the same target every turn. Okay, that makes them really powerful. So they can combine all their cannons together. They can stack to get three dice to fire in one direction if you want to shoot at one particular enemy ship. Yep, they get three dice thrown at them. So that's really, really powerful. Capturing a shore fort. I'm going to keep saying that all the time wrong. To capture a shore fort, move your ship so that it is touching the shore fort template. Roll a dice on a one or a two. You have miscalculated your maneuver and run aground. Wow. Whether or not you have run aground, you may conduct a boarding action as normal. The shore fort fires its guns in defense. The shore fort adds plus one to its dice rolls as the defender are protected by huge stone walls. Wow. I don't know if I want to try to do that. I think just shooting it would be the best idea. Then it goes into shore forts and other games. Okay, so you can buy one for 100 points each and deploy them as squadrons in your fleet, but they can be placed anywhere within a section of your side of the table. And everything else applies to the rules for shore forts, as we just talked about. So that's quite cool. I quite like the shore fort, and that's another addition that you can add to your fleet when you purchase your 1,000 points or whatever it might be that you agree with your opponent. Yeah, to spend an extra 100 points, if you've got 100 points free, might as well get a shore fort. I think it's pretty good. I think it's really good. I mean, they've got to take it out to get the 5 battle honors, and it's not easy to do because every location has a 3+ save. So that's excellent. And they're throwing 3 dice, which is just like a wolf ship, basically, for the Empire. So, yeah, I'm really impressed with those. And, I look forward to actually trying this scenario. So I'll have to ask one of the guys if they want to play that with me at some point. Okay, so we're going to wrap up this section then. And when we come back, we can look at the campaigns for Wannermore. Okay, we'll see you back in a second. Okay, guys, and welcome. We're now to the final part in the rulebook now with campaigns. And thank you for sticking with us so far. But just hang in there because we're almost done. We've only got a couple more pages to go. So campaigns give more structure to your games. Again, games of Man of War, your ships will earn battle honors, gain experience, and become more powerful in future battles. A campaign can create a string of epic battles at sea from the shores of the Southlands to the estuary of the Reich. So, this is just a really nice little two-page, outset of how to set up a campaign with your fellow gamers playing Man of War. And I really like the idea of campaigns, and we don't really get to play many campaigns in other games, and I'd like to do that more often because I like the nature of building up some kind of story and creating characters of your own, and in this case your own admirals and that kind of thing, the names of your ships. They've got like a fleet campaign roster which is on the very back of the rulebook that you can obviously photocopy, and you can write in the name of your ships or squadron names and that kind of thing for your ships of the line, and the admiral's name and the wizard and all that kind of stuff. It's quite cool to take notes and keep track of your progress through your campaign. So how do we play a campaign? Okay, well, basically you have to initiate some kind of points value that you're going to set and create your list from. So generally about 1,000 points, but you can make it smaller or bigger or whatever it might be. That just as long as you have the same amount of points with the other players in it. It says here the campaign is a series of battles between two fleets. So it doesn't. I suppose you can work it out or just make it so that you can include other people in your campaign as well. I don't see why you couldn't do it. So I don't think it's, you know, sort of stipulates that it only has to be two people. You can have more than two, I'm sure. Now, so once you've decided on a points value, you create your fleet as normal, including all the Mana War cards or wizards that you're going to take, and these are fixed. They can't be changed at all during the campaign. Then you need to decide on which scenario you're going to play, or maybe a series of scenarios that you're going to play. Maybe you just say, okay, well, this campaign's only going to be like six scenarios, could be more than six. They've got a little table here that you can roll, and you can randomly generate the scenarios as you play. So that's quite a good idea. And I like the sort of, you know, the randomness to the scenario, or you can sort of preset a series of link games during your campaign. So that's pretty straightforward. Okay, so we talked a little bit about battle honors before, and they take more importance now in the campaign rules as they increase or give more, you gain more experience with your crews. So once you've acquired enough battle honors, you can upgrade your inexperienced crewmen, because everyone starts as being inexperienced when you start the campaign. And it's got a chart here of the battle honors you'll need in order to upgrade your inexperienced crews to various different crew titles. The first one is being, if you have four battle honors, you can increase them to being sailors. So they're now classed as being sailors, and their crew level is one. So you do that for all the crews on each individual ship. So if you have six ships in your fleet, you can allocate, depending on how many battle honors you acquire during each battle. And we know that, you know, when you sink ships, or when you scuttle ships, or when you kill the admiral, kill the wizard, and that kind of thing, you're accumulating all these battle honors. So it's four battle honors to make them sailors, okay, the crew level one. 12 battle honors to make them veterans, and that's a crew level of two. 24 battle honors gets you a Sea Dogs title with a crew level of three. 40 battle honors gets you the title of Cutthroats with a crew level of four. And then 60 battle honors give them Elite with a crew level of five. Now, once you've upgraded your crews, and I think, you know, once you've just upgraded them to just being sailors, it doesn't really matter which one it is, but as soon as you upgrade them, they achieve a new level of abilities and benefits. The first one being Superior Commander. The captain may be experienced enough to act independently, even if separated from his squadron flagship, by more than 6 inches at the start of a turn. At the start of his squadron's battle phase, you can make a navigation check, roll a dice, adding the ship's crew level. If the result is greater than seven, then the ship is not a straggler and may move and fight normally that phase. So that's quite a handy one. You've got Master Gunners. Because of their experience, your crew may make an inspired gunnery check. When you come to fire, roll a dice and add the ship's crew level. If the result is greater than seven, they can fire twice this phase. And the Battle-Hardened Crew. Because of the greater morale and proven fighting ability, an experienced crew gets to add their crew level to their dice roll during any boarding actions they take part in. So they're all really good. They're all really good benefits. So the more experienced your crew, the higher the level. Obviously, Elite being five, you just need to get seven or more in those Master Gunner or Superior Command rolls. The Master Gunner's one is really lethal. So let's look at an example here in the book. So the Sigmar, an Imperial warship, has acquired 12 battle honors, making it a level 2 ship with a crew of veterans. It is approaching the El Honor, a Bretonian corsair with an unexperienced crew who have not yet achieved level 1. Once the Sigmar makes contact with the El Honor, its movement ends. The Imperial player fires all three of his Sigmar's forward guns. First, he checks if his gunners feel inspired. He rolls a dice, adds his level, he gets a 5 on the dice, 5 plus 2 is 7, so the check is a success. He fires the guns twice, raking the Bretonian with 6 dice of cannon fire. Having knocked out all the Corsair's guns with his mighty salvo, the Sigmar's crew decide it's time to get to grips with the dazed Bretonians. The boarding action begins. The Sigmar has three crew counters and the Leona only has two. With a mighty shout, the Imperial soldiers storm aboard, rolling a three on their dice. To this, they add their three boarding parties and the crew's level of two, which makes their total eight. The Bretonians, unable to load their cannon with grapeshot because they have no undamaged guns, roll a five. To this, they add their score of two to a total of seven. Despite heroic Bretonian resistance, the Empire's finest soldiers cut their way to victory. The Bretonian loses a crew counter. Imperial victory looks almost assured. It surely does. But having to fire twice, especially with wolf ships, is really, 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 really devastating. So you can really crush somebody. Six shots. It's just amazing. They can make them quite powerful. I suppose it depends on the ships, I guess. But even for your really sort of, your lower class, smaller ships of the line, it can make them quite lethal then, if they can shoot twice and get the added level to their boarding actions. So it talks about continuity. One of the greatest benefits of the campaign is continuity, the players using the same ships and fleet and watching them grow in power and experience. During a campaign, you should keep a note of the color of your fleet's wizard. It will remain the same from game to game. If the wizard is lost during the battle, his college will replace him with a wizard of the same mastery level before the next battle. You should also note which Man of War cards a ship has assigned to it. These will be the same from game to game unless the ship is sunk. Yeah, now, if ships are sunk, this is really bad because they lose all their experience, basically. All their battle honors are gone. So all the experienced crew have drowned, and they start again being inexperienced crew. But the good thing is, if a ship is lost, your fleet will commission a new one before the next battle. The sunken ship will be replaced with one of the same type. If the sunken ship had any Man of War cards, draw the same number of new ones and assign them to that ship. So that way you get basically a redraw. So maybe if the draw you had initially wasn't that good, you get a bit of a double dip there. So that's one, maybe possibly a good thing. If the original ship had any engineers or war dancers or other special troops aboard, then the new ship will have them too. So that's quite good, they get replaced as well. This ship will have a fresh crew and no battle honors, although it may earn them in the same way as any other ship. The ship will be assigned to the same squadron as the ship it replaces. In this way, you will always start each battle with the same number of squadrons and ships as you begin the campaign with, although they will probably be of different levels of experience. Now, winning the campaign. Okay, so after the first battle, you should roll on the scenario table to find out what your next battle will be. Place appropriate counters telling you the level of your crew on the templates of any ships that you have gained, that have gained a new level of experience. After the next battle, tally up your battle honors and award them as before. Repeat this process until you have fought the agreed number of battles. After the last battle, each player should add up the total battle honors acquired by all his surviving ships over the duration of the entire campaign. The winner of the campaign is the person whose surviving ships have the most battle honors. So you're not actually, even though you might be winning games by the total amount of battle honors that you acquire from game to game, but you're only really the winner at the end. So even if you do lose games during the campaign, you could end up being the winner depending on your results overall. Now, the last part they talk about is Lily Livered Cowards. Okay, it's quite a funny title, but you'll see why. So any player who sails his fleet directly off the table without firing a shot, with no intention of fighting the enemy or achieving the scenario objective, is obviously a Lily Livered Coward. His opponent is immediately awarded the value of the coward's entire fleet in battle honors, since his lads are heartened by facing a fleet whose admiral is such a yellow-bellied dog. Any fleet which does this twice in a campaign has its admiral executed and automatically loses the campaign. This rule is meant to stop one player from winning a battle and then never fighting again, thus winning a campaign by default. It does not apply to any scenario that specifically calls for one player to flee a superior force, for example. So maybe they included this because someone actually did this in their playtesting. Or maybe they just did this because they thought, oh, okay, well, maybe someone's going to do this, obviously, and we just want to stamp this out and put a rule in it. I don't know who would do that, but I think don't be a dick really applies to that. And that's it, guys. That's the end. That's the whole book. They've got a little section in the back here, of course, that goes through all the models that were currently available at that time for the Empire, Bretonian ships, how to assemble your flags. They've got like all the masts. When you get the sprues, they've all got sort of number codings on them. And then they'll have like instructions in your boxes when you buy them. And on the flag pieces of paper, they'll have a little guide to how to assemble them and what, you know, sections of masts you need and what sails match each ship and that kind of thing, which is quite handy because sometimes if you've never done it before, it can be a little bit daunting as to which sections you should be cutting out and which sections you'd be gluing, and you don't want to make a mistake because you don't want things to look out of place or a bit strange or things looking too big or small or whatever. I have made a couple of mistakes with mine, so yeah, it's good just to check with your guides and to see how they're assembled. So I really hope you've enjoyed learning a little bit more about Man of War. I've really enjoyed playing it. I got a chance to play again this weekend on Saturday evening with Marcel, and we had a cracking game. We played the second scenario, which was, let me just check, Treacherous Waters, and that has all, like, basically you put down all the terrain pieces that you have in the box. Marcel started doing that, and then he decided he wanted to use his three-dimensional terrain, like the plastic stuff that comes from Dreadfleet. So we used that, and it caused that bottleneck that you see in most games when you have lots of terrain. And it was interesting. It was a really, really fun game. It really came down to the wire. You may have seen photos of it on the Chrono Command community page already, or in the Man of War Facebook group. But yeah, we had a great time again. I'm really enjoying Man of War. Every experience is so good. And I just want more and more of it. And by the end of it, we'll talk about like campaigns the next morning, and you know, we should try doing that. I would love to do that. I think Marcel is keen to paint more of his ships. He's doing a really wonderful job. If you haven't seen his painted ship so far, he's doing stellar work there in getting his models painted. And we're actually playing games, and we're doing it remotely on through the Discord channel, and it's working fine. I think the measurements, like, I can gauge it pretty well because I'm the guest player, and I've got a pretty good sense of, you know, the distances between things, and you know, it hasn't really come up with any really major issues at all. It's only like a technical point of view where sometimes the camera cuts out and you know, you've got to reset the camera and that kind of thing. That's the only real drama, but apart from that, it's been working a treat, and you know, we've been really enjoying it. So you know, if you know, for example, it's best if both players have their own set, so that I can use my own magic cards. It's a bit like when we play Warhammer Fantasy Battles as well. It's best if the remote player, the guest in this case, would have their own magic deck or their own magic items or whatever, so that they can sort of draw them from their side rather than me, you know, someone holding up the cards in front of a camera and that kind of thing. That just doesn't work. So we've been really enjoying that, and I think me and Marcel will line up some more games, and Ben as well. And talking about Ben, we've been talking through the week, and we're gonna go over all the expansions. There were two. There was Plague Fleet. That was the one that was released next, and we're gonna do those in chronicle order. So the next one was Plague Fleet, and that covered all the, you know, the big bad nasties of the old world. So that's Chaos and all their various four, like the four main gods: Khorne, Tzeentch, Slaanesh, and Nurgle. And we'll look at those fleets and how they operate in Man of War. Fairly much the same, but a lot of their ships have got special rules, which sort of play into their, you know, their play style. which is very similar to what they do in other games of Games Workshop's IP. Then we've got Chaos Dwarves and we've got Skaven, and Skaven are probably my favorite of all of the fleets mentioned in the Plague Fleet set. I haven't played them yet. I played against them with Ben and they've been really fun. But yeah, they look really cool. They've got their own magic. Chaos have their own magic as well. They've got their own spells and that kind of thing. Their magic and the way the Skaven work as well, a little bit different from college magic. But yeah, as I said, we'll go in a bit of a deep dive in Plague Fleet and then later on in Sea of Blood as well, so we can cover all the expansions. So hopefully, you know, this little venture has been a success, but you know, I want to get more guests on talking about different things and coming on with me to talk about these games so that we can broaden the awareness of them and how they play. So the people who are sort of, like I say, on the fence, they don't know if they want to, you know, invest in these old games of the 90s, well, maybe we have convinced them somehow, or maybe they just think, oh well, it's actually not for me. But hopefully it is, because yeah, if you have never played them, you're really missing out, and I'm really glad I've invested in Manor War, that's for sure. All right, guys. Well, look. Let's finish it for now. We'll look forward to coming back with another podcast in the future. Until then, please, everybody, stay safe. Hope you're enjoying your painting time. Come over to the Crown of Command community page if you want to see the guys painting for the Call of the Crown painting challenge that we've got at the moment. Head over to Discord. Just look for the Crown of Command podcast. You'll find us there, and join us there if you want to. If you want to do something external from Facebook, if Facebook's not your thing, then Discord's becoming more and more popular and quite lively, with lots of different posts from different people on various projects they're working on, all related to Herohammer though. Otherwise, come to the YouTube channel as well if that's your thing. We have a channel set up there that I try to update weekly if I can. And coming up soon, it will be a pretty big Warhammer Fantasy Battles video that I just shot today. We just finished playing it for the Grudge of Drong, the final battle, which was a great day. And we had Justin and Paul up here playing that with me today. So it was really good. So look forward to that. And in other news, we have another podcast coming up shortly, probably next weekend, talking about Epic. I'm going to start talking about Epic now. It's Epic Space Marine 2nd Edition, released in 1991. I did that with John Webb, and we had a great, great time. We've fixed up the remote, you know, interviews. The recordings are much better. So don't worry, guys. We're getting back on track. So we're really pleased. I'm so happy that, you know, we can have some really good quality recordings now. So that's the most important thing for you guys too. So guys, until then, take care and we'll catch the next one. Okay, bye-bye.